So tonight I'd like to offer some reflections about nature. It's some practices that the Buddha taught for staying in contact with, grounded in a restful, content sense of presence. And I've found these practices helpful, whether at the beginning of a formal sitting to support mindfulness, or to support awareness of awareness during formal walking, or as a resource, a landing place during the day. So it's sort of lightly touching on the elements and the elemental qualities, which is a little bit similar to the day long at the end of this week, but it will be significantly different. The three main points I'd like to cover today is that we can use contemplation, that is intentional thought, directed thought, as well as embodied experience to stay present in the moment. And second, that we can notice these amazing sense faculties we have: sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, heart and mind, as ways of being supported in a felt experience of now. And then third, that noticing and inquiring into that capacity for awareness in our hearts and minds themselves helps each of us notice, choose how to respond to the moment. So that's the map of where we're going. And I'll start by talking about something. I'm sure I've mentioned this before in this group, and certainly in other groups, that the Buddha taught his young 7-year-old son, Rahula, to model his practice, to draw inspiration from nature. And the way he did this was to begin mindfulness of breathing, noticing his visceral body, and then to also allow the natural elements to infuse his practice, become part of his practice. Meditators throughout history have done this. Li Bai, also known as Li Po in the Zen tradition, wrote a haiku many centuries ago: "The birds have vanished down the sky. Now the last cloud drains away. We sit together, the mountain and me, until only the mountain remains." That's Zazen Nanjingting Mountain. And I love sharing that haiku because it's resonant with some of the things the Buddha shared with his son. This is less poetic but far more ancient, come from the Pali Suttas. "Rahula," that is, son, "develop meditation that is like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind and remain. Just as people throw clean things and dirty things, excrement, urine, spittle, pus, and blood on the earth, and the earth is not repelled, humiliated, or disgusted, so too, son, develop meditation like the earth. For when you develop meditation that is like the earth, agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not repel, disgust, or control you. They will not invade your mind or remain." So the invitation the Buddha makes to his son and to all of us as practitioners by proxy is to take in that kind of vastness, that solidity, that mountain-like strength. And there are simple ways of doing this. Personally, I find this particular form of contemplation, meditation like the earth, easiest when walking on the earth, hiking meditation, or taking a walk around the neighborhood, and just noticing that contact between the body and earth beneath it. It can also be done internally, noticing solidity, hardness, weight, heaviness, lightness. I mentioned in the guided meditation noticing the hardness of our teeth, or perhaps if your nails are strong, the hardness of your nails. So this is intentional directed thought for the purpose of being more present. It also hints at something quite profound. As some indigenous peoples of the Andes say, we are earth walking. We are earth walking. What is inside of us literally came from the earth. Everything we've eaten came from the earth. Minerals, composites, all of it. So to check in with yourself. That sense of connection that can happen, recognizing that. And the elemental quality of air can be tapped into, as many of us do, by noticing the breath in meditation. Motion inside the body. Wind or breeze or stillness around you. Movement or stillness within us. Noticing that moment when air becomes breath on the inhale and breath becomes air on the exhale. There's also taking nourishment from, at least where I am right now, these kind of sultry summer breezes that start to come up right about this time of afternoon, evening. A little bit of coolness. Welcome respite from the heat. And there is developing meditation like fire. So each of these, the Buddha instructs his son to do. The fire burns up the disagreeable contacts, the difficult things. And it's a fire, a heat of determination in the practice, as well as the warmth of care, to care for your own heart and to care for other human beings, other living beings, sentient beings. And more literally, noticing the visceral warmth or coolness inside. Then there's meditation like water. And I picture the vastness of the ocean when picturing this meditation, how the ocean can be a teacher to allow your meditation to be oceanic. The waves at the surface can be quite different than the calm, the coolness, the vastness underneath. It gets very quiet down there. If any of you have ever scuba dived, you know this. I used to be a scuba diver back when I was much younger. And about 15 feet down, the wave surge goes away completely. And all of a sudden, there might be some tide, but it can be quite peaceful. Is there a way to let that be our teacher? To drop beneath the surface chop of the mind and the heart and the day's activities or the day's memories and be with the coolness deeper in. When I was, one of my trips to Asia, I would stay at this Thai temple, Wat Tham Yai Prik, which was named for an enlightened woman. I always loved that. And perhaps not coincidentally, there were lots of nuns there, Buddhist nuns, tons of them. Because the abbot clearly, the founder and abbot who named the place, clearly recognized women's capacity to fully awaken. And they were beautiful teachers, mostly silent teachers. And one of the reasons they were such beautiful teachers is there were two main practices there. Maranasati, or mindfulness of death, which is a topic for another time, and open-eyed ocean gazing. And the teacher, the instruction was to take in the wisdom and flow of the ocean and allow all of your postures to be that graceful. Sitting, moving from sitting to standing, standing to walking, and lying down. To take your inspiration, and these women modeled this. It was just beautiful to watch them walk. It was like poetry or dance. Every movement had this gracious, wave-like intentionality to it. And the other component of that instruction was to open the gaze wide, broad, take in the whole vista of the ocean until the sky and the ocean became one. Air and water became one. Which I learned was a metaphor for the kind of the self collapsing into nature in a very beautiful way. So this is part of what elemental meditation teaches, is this capacity for union, the nature within us and the nature around us. At a simpler level, we can tune into it by noticing the water in us, tears, saliva. Hopefully you're not noticing your blood too directly, but knowing that it's there. Everything. Drinking. And then developing meditation-like space. That same Thai temple had a saying. It was in the little booklet that the abbot wrote, and it was on some of, they had these signs in Thai and English. We are simply meditators under the vast sky. It was just this humility built right in, this sense of place, taking in the spaciousness of the sky and the fact that space is not established anywhere. It's kind of everywhere and nowhere. It's inside of us. If we didn't have it inside of us, we would be teeny, teeny, tiny and very heavy. We have lots of space in us. I find this comforting to remember on days when my mind is contracted, that, oh, there's actually a lot of space in there. It also speaks to some contemporary understanding. As Carl Sagan famously said, the cosmos is within us. We are made of star stuff. We are ways for the universe to know itself. The universe to know itself. And there can be these moments where the self drops out of the way and it can just feel like the knowing is there. At a simpler level, noticing the space between trees, between branches, between houses and sky, between forests and sky, hills and horizon. Noticing your own body occupying space right now. There's space around you. Noticing the body occupying space while walking around and doing your thing. It's a beautiful entry point to beginning to notice awareness itself, the capacity to be aware. You can ask yourself, am I aware in this moment? It's a trick question. If you can ask the question, the answer is yes, I am. And how does coming into present awareness, even my invoking the name of it, shift your relationship to your senses right now? Just notice. For some people, it brightens the visual field or simplifies the experience of sitting. Or maybe it makes another sense more acute. So this brings us to our senses themselves, which is a favorite topic of mine. This is a favorite practice of mine, working with the sense doors. Some of you have heard me talk about this before. Noticing that they are touch points, supports for the simplicity of the present moment. You can always tap into any comfort, any stillness in a sense experience. I find it a really useful way to relax and step back from the flurries of my mind or my day, and instead relaxing into a felt sense of breath or body or simply seeing or hearing and tasting. That's a big one. And relax into that. So in the eyes, the difference between looking and seeing. Softening, connecting to the visual field itself, which can be accessed with your eyes closed too. Bringing that focus to the senses often takes energy and momentum away from whatever's happening in the mind. And for many of us, a lot of the time, that can be a good thing. And break the cycle of whatever's happening that might not be useful, or it might not just be very interesting. It doesn't happen to me very often, but the last few days I've had an earworm in daily life, an earworm meaning a song that just won't give up. It's like three strands of a song. We've all had this. But moving to another sense door, or even moving to actual hearing, cuts it. Cuts it. Dissolves it, even briefly. And speaking of hearing, noticing the gaps between sounds, even the little moments of stillness between my words, that can also be a way to start to invite the heart and the mind to rest in the silences that are in our day. To find silence. And then I mentioned taste earlier, smell as well. We've all had a scent that we find like takes us back 20 years or brings us into the moment. Maybe it's baking bread or the smell of coffee or as we were meditating, the breeze blew over my neighbor's flowers and I got this amazing fragrant scent just while meditating. That too can be an invitation to savor. Just savor. Be in the moment. Noticing the flavor and texture of the moment literally and even less literally, the sense of mood, the flavor of awareness, the flavor of your heart and mind in this moment. You can also notice the embodied sensations, not just of breathing, but a kinesthetic sense, internal, interoception. Can you find a place in the body that's content? Or it can be equally useful, sometimes more useful, to notice leaning forward into the moment or pulling back, bracing against, or softening into. Grounding in the body, noticing these things, offers information as well as stability. And that begins to open the door to noticing the about to moment, the impulses that move through our bodies. Noticing the instinct to move. That can allow for inquiry. What's the attitude in the mind? What's the function of the attitude. I find it really useful some days to notice how I'm relating to inanimate objects. It's a clue as to my overall mind state. Am I treating that little object of technology or object in the kitchen with care and tenderness, or is there frustration, roughness? Our bodies offer so many clues, so many clues. But what's useful and what isn't in our attitude? If that frustration, aversion, anger, its function is to separate, divide. Whereas the tenderness, appreciation, kindness, the Buddha's ancient teachings say provide cohesion, fluidity. These qualities aren't me or you. They're pretty much universal among people, and there's no sense in getting discouraged by taking them personally or getting puffed up by taking them personally. It's impersonal as the sun or the fog or the rain or the wind. The function of greed is to get, to want. And that can feel kind of grabby and unpleasant too sometimes. I heard this study years ago. It was just a little blurb of a study, maybe on NPR or something, that the moment of maximum happiness when shopping was the moment of handing the credit card over. It wasn't after you got the thing. It was that moment. This was before many of us did a lot of online shopping, of course. So it's probably the moment of the click nowadays. So the greed can feel good, but it can also feel contracting. And it can inspire its opposite, loss aversion, which feels really contracting. Instead, contentment, generosity, simplicity function to open the grasp, the contraction of the heart and mind. It's an alternative. It was a big turning point in my own practice when I began to choose simplicity and contentment on purpose. Like if the mind was sort of waffling between contentment and greed, to choose the contentment and let go of the need to grab the thing. And it just invited more and more contentment over time. And then there's the attitude and function of delusion, confusion, ignorance. And that's, of course, many of you know this, the basis for greed and aversion, for craving. To misdirect, to confuse. And all of these functions of mind interrelate with each other, right? They condition each other. Acting on craving nurtures more craving. Acting on contentment nurtures more contentment. Craving, if seen, becomes a mindfulness bell. That can be quite beautiful. And then it can inspire awareness or even wisdom. A little story. This was years ago, many years ago. Cheese was my favorite food, bar none. And I wasn't, I mean, nicer cheeses, but it didn't have to be super fancy, right? And then gradually it became clear that I had developed an allergy to my favorite food. Oh, it was so interesting. I was a practitioner by this time, thank goodness, to see the object of my desire, this little cube or spread or whatever, and watch the craving coming up. And as one does, trying to make dietary changes, there's, you know, at first there's experimentation. Is this really a problem? Really? And then having it, and yeah, actually it's really unpleasant afterwards. It didn't take all that many times of paying mindful attention through the entire arc of wanting, getting, tasting, eating, and then suffering the consequences before the mind woke up and was like, that's not good. Look at the outputs of this. That's no good at all. So then, that very craving began to bring up the wisdom. Oh, this is the effect. And then the craving would vanish and eventually replaced by the wisdom entirely. So it's a simple little example. Many of us have done this in our own lives, noticing the trajectory between what's wholesome and what isn't wholesome, what's skillful and isn't, useful and isn't over time. That awareness, that wisdom, each input something different into the system. It's true of the contemplative practices, like the elements, the nature practices. And it's also true of wisdom gained by practicing with the visceral sensations, breath, mental activity of the body. This is a poem by a nun from ancient China, awakened woman. Just an excerpt. Her name is Ben Ming. Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom? But to cling to your afflictions is nothing more than foolishness. As they rise and melt away again, you must remember this. A sparrowhawk flies through the sky without anyone noticing. Don't you know that afflictions are nothing more than wisdom, and that the purest of lotus blossoms emerges from the mire? If someone were to come and ask me what I do, after eating, I wash my bowl. Don't worry about a thing. Don't worry about a thing. The naturalness, the ease of being able to relate to even the things that don't feel good in the mind and heart as a source of wisdom. It's a process, and it's deeply trustable. Just by noticing, cultivating wholesome, skillful, kind regard through awareness, things start to shift. And by cultivating that kind of wise attitude towards what's already happening, kindness, generosity of heart, equanimity, patience, all of these shift the interrelationships within, the nature, the ecology within. Ajahn Chah, one of the venerable elders of this tradition, said, "The future is the child of the present moment. If you take care of the mother, she will take care of her child." So, the encouragement is to take care of this moment in your own heart, in your own mind, whether it's through tapping into the senses, and resting in the support of those, or whether it's drawing inspiration from the earth, from the air, from breath, from fire, oceanic water, space. All of it can help nourish the present moment. It can rest in that simple, intimate connection. And over time, that cultivates more and more freedom of the heart and mind. So thank you very much for your kind attention. Those are my thoughts for this evening. We have time for questions or comments if you would like. Yes, Nancy, please.
John, I don't have a question particularly, but I just have to say what a lovely talk that was. And I love the earth walking. You know, I take so many walks. I try to take a walk every day. And I love that context. And I will carry that with me.
Wonderful. Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you.
Yes, Mary.
So I really find that actually contemplating something, like you said, and in your meditation, it's just like the part when you said, like, you're behind your eyes, and I could feel the way it was like I was there. And it was interesting because years ago that would get very tight, and anymore now it doesn't. Now it's just, it's like there is, it's very spacious and it's very soft, and for me that is almost a gateway to a very expansive awareness. I find it's easier for me to maintain my concentration if I using the elements and guiding my attention to different parts of my body and following my breath. There's a certain stability that I find that is very helpful. Does it always work? No. But when I'm really, my mind is just spinning, you know, it doesn't want to stop, I find if I can just gently bring it to something and pay attention. And a lot of times it can be, just something is just the earth element for me is just a really good one to sit there. And I can, there's, for me, there's stillness in that. And the physical stillness that I feel gets expansive. And that in turn brings a certain stillness to my mind heart, which is, you know, because I have found that trying to force it, don't think, doesn't work. It doesn't work. And so if I can give myself, I feel like a 2-year-old sometimes that has something it shouldn't. You can't just take it away. You need to give it something else. And that's what I feel like I need to do. So your meditation was really lovely. And it was it's a good reminder that I for me that's so very helpful. So, and I do also like the whole business of like walking on earth, you know, and I do, I take walks too. It's just walking in my yard and it's just like, yeah. So thank you. It was lovely, lovely.
Thank you, Mary. Thank you very much for the reflections. And I think most of us, most of our minds need something else to grab onto at certain times, right? I mean, that's why there's all these different contemplations in the ancient teachings, right? I don't think the human mind has changed all that much in the last 2,600 years. The circumstances around us have changed. The mind still needs things to, little handholds often. And then there are days where it's peaceful and quiet and you can just like drop in and that's great. But this starting to attend to more and more of the spaciousness and the simplicity as you're able to. Tan Jeff, Tanisra Bhikkhu, calls that trading candy for gold. Trading candy for gold. It's like the candy is social media or whatever, and then that dropping in, however it works that day, whether it's earth walking or the space behind the eyes or the oceanic awareness available if you look at the horizon. However it is, sometimes it can feel like a slog, but it's so worth it. So thank you very much for that. Any other questions or comments?
Marion has a comment.
Okay. Oh, that was your hand. I couldn't tell if it was your hand or if you were just moving. There we are.
That's my hand. Oh, I'm home with a horrible case of COVID.
Oh.
Didn't think I didn't I came the very I came very light here because I kept saying, well, what's it gonna do for me? I feel so awful. Is it gonna, I don't know. But I decided I just wanted to see everybody who I miss. Because I've been pretty much home for I don't know, forever. So I'm glad that I came.
I'm really glad you came.
People. And I'm in so much pain. I have other, all my other illnesses and ailments are like in a big mush with the COVID. And I wish I could just focus on COVID. That would be sort of simple. I used to, never mind. That's all. I just wanted to connect.
Thank you for putting your voice in the room, and I hope some of what we've been sharing is a respite from the unpleasantness. COVID's pretty awful, especially now.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jan, please.
I want to thank you for open-eyed ocean gazing. I just love the phrase. And I think I'm going to have to do it without an ocean, but that'll be, I'm pretty good at putting up pictures. So just, and maybe with my eyes shut. So maybe it'll be shut-eyed without an ocean gazing. I don't know.
So that's beautiful. I will tell you that I sat a Zen retreat last summer, and one of the instructions, which I'd never heard before, I'd sat Sesshin before, was to close your eyes or soften them and just look at something blank, like a wall or the sky, and imagine as if you're looking over the horizon, broad horizon, like the Grand Canyon or a mountain range or an ocean. And what it does, kind of, this is kind of to Mary's point too, what it does to the eyes is it softens them. And there's something about that that broadens the awareness to this really spacious place for a lot of people. So I want to encourage you. We know we've been talking about the elements, but there are other skillful ways to use our wonderful minds, our capacity.
I love it. And like Mary said, I need to plug something in if I hear the busyness going. So I added something to what you said about noting and then adding the one more piece I had not done, which is savor. Yes.
Yes, please savor. Savoring is so good for us and so good for our minds.
Was a new word for me. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for your comment and your practice.